The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thank you, Peter. Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Great to see you. As Peter said, we're talking about the future, and at the risk of stating the obvious, what you believe about the future will very much affect the present. Now, here's a man with a particular view about the future. Yuval Noah Harari is a lecturer in history at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's written two bestsellers. Actually, there's a third one out. I don't know how that'll sell, but the two bestsellers have been Sapiens, released in 2011, and Homo Deus in 2015. The idea is that it's a history of mankind, of humanity, and looking into the future. Now, in Sapiens, what he talks about is three great revolutions that the human race has had. The cognitive revolution, he puts about 70,000 years ago, when we developed language and the ability to have non-physical entities like states and religions and companies, etc., and allowed us to get organized. Second revolution, the agricultural revolution, about 12,000 years ago, and then the scientific revolution about 500 years ago. And his vision of the future is that humanity will conquer the three great evils of plague, famine, and war. In fact, he goes so far as to say we've pretty much nailed that already. And ultimately, we will conquer death. So here's a quote. Modern science and modern culture have an entirely different take on life and death. They don't think of death as a metaphysical mystery, and they certainly don't think of it as a source of life's meaning. Rather, for modern people, death is a technical problem that we can and should solve. So there you go. Death's a technical problem that we'll deal with. And we will become, indeed, the future masters of the world will probably be more different from us than we are from Neanderthals. I'm assuming most of us are. Whereas we and the Neanderthals are at least human, our inheritors will be godlike. Humanity, eventually, we will become godlike. And, of course, if our inheritors function on a different level of consciousness, it seems doubtful that Christianity or Islam will be of interest to them. And so we'll conquer death, we'll become godlike, etc. In fact, the Homo Deus, of course, means divine man or God-man. But he does, just occasionally, touch the brake pedal labelled reality. In truth, so far, modern medicine hasn't extended our natural lifespan by a single year. Its great achievement has been to save us from premature death and allow us to enjoy the full measure of our years. There's just a touch on the handbrake. As well as that, there's a kind of an existential crisis that he's aware of. He says, moreover, despite the astonishing thing that humans are capable of doing, we remain unsure of our goals and we seem to be as disconnected as ever. We've advanced from canoes to galleys to steamships to space shuttles, but nobody knows where we're going. We're more powerful than ever before, but have very little idea what to do with that power. Worse still, humans seem to be more irresponsible than ever. Self-made gods with only the laws of physics to keep us company. We're accountable to no one. We're consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystem, seeking little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. I think apart from that, everything's going pretty well. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want? Interesting. He's a very clever man and a great writer. And I disagree with almost everything he says, but I love reading it. Now, what do you believe about the future? It's worth thinking about. What do you believe about the future? Well, the human race, the planet, and individually. Obviously, that makes a massive difference to how we live in the present and what we think about it. Now, I thought it was a delicious irony as I come to Daniel chapter 2 that Homo Deus, his strapline is a brief history of tomorrow. In your hand or on the table in front of you is Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 is the Bible's answer to a brief history of tomorrow. In fact, what Daniel chapter 2 offers is a brief history of tomorrow. Let me put Daniel in context quickly in case you weren't here last year, and we'll have a look at what Daniel chapter 2 says. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the new, well, about to be inaugurated as the emperor of the Babylonian Empire, came and conquered Jerusalem. He conquered Jerusalem three times in total over about 15 years. He took, if I could say, the cream of the crop in terms of the population out of Jerusalem, transported them to Babylon. Babylon's about, or the ruins of Babylon, 100 and something kilometres south of Baghdad. He took the cream of the crop, and then he took the best of the best, and they were drafted into a three-year kind of internship, and then their job would be to work in the king's civil service. They would be, quote, wise men or administrators to help the king run the empire. It seems like they had a three-year internship. It seems like Daniel chapter 2 may well happen during this internship. Now, I'm going to read Daniel chapter 2, most of it, and most of it very quickly. I've left out some parts. You might like to read it at your leisure later. Here we go. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. In the early part of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar was fighting battles on the edges of the empire, which was massive, stretched right up into Turkey, over to Persia, down to Egypt. And so he had a lot on his mind. He's troubled. So we're told. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I've had a dream that troubles me. I want to know what it means." And the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it." Now, for them, this was just another day at work. They had dream manuals that you name what the thing is that you dreamed about. They'd look up the manual, say, this means X, Y, Z. Because there was a belief that dreams were the way in which the gods communicated to you. So it's just another day at work. It takes a very bad turn for the astrologers at verse 5. The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble." Piles of rubble is a euphemism. It actually means a public latrine. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honour. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. There's a little bit of a translation problem with some of the earlier English translations had that Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the dream. It seems unlikely. It seems more like he is just putting the astrologers to the test. Can you tell me what the dream was? And then can you interpret it? If you can do one, I'm sure you can do the other. I won't read the whole thing. The astrologers squeal, understandably, and say no one can do this. No man can. What the king asks is impossible. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in his usual subtle way, just decides he will kill all the wise men in Babylon. When they decided to cut heads in the Babylonian civil service, I really meant it. And so the order goes out to round up all the wise men, astrologers, administrators. Daniel and his three friends are caught up in that. The reason I think it happens during their internship is they weren't in the initial kind of inner ring that were asked to do this. They're just kind of caught up in the wave. Daniel is told what the problem is. Daniel somehow manages to get access to the king and to plead for another day to give an answer. They pray to the God of heaven, their God, the God of Israel, and during the night, see verse 19, during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven. And so Daniel goes in, I've cut down to verse 26. He turns up, the head of administration says, "I've found the man who can answer this." Verse 26, the king asked Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, which is the Babylonian name he was given, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" And then Daniel says, "Yeah, I can, but only because God has revealed it to me. God has shown you, king, what is about to happen." So verse 31, the dream is explained. Now I'm going to read this quickly. I won't take it through the screen. Hang in there with me. I'll read it quickly and then we'll make some comments. Here we go. Verse 31. Daniel explains the dream. "Your majesty looked and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver and the gold and all the broken pieces became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the whole statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth." Okay, interesting. But what does it mean? Well, Daniel explains it, verse 36. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, verse 37, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky. From their worldview, Nebuchadnezzar ruled the world. Okay. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. Verse 39, after you, another kingdom will arise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Verse 41, just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Hence the expression feet of clay. Okay, be a divided kingdom, yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. Verse 44. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of the mountain, but not by human hands, a rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and its interpretation is trustworthy. Was Daniel correct? Well, here's a little Sunday school picture of Nebuchadnezzar bowing down in front of Daniel. My guess is it was just a little on the awkward side is what it says. Let's see verse 46. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honour and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. Nebuchadnezzar is deeply impressed. Well, that means he's ready to worship Daniel, I don't think, but just deeply impressed. Verse 47, the king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings, a revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery. And the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and placed him in charge of all its wise men. But Daniel also remembers his mates. Verse 49, moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, three other young Jewish men taken from Jerusalem, administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained in the royal court. Incidentally, that may explain why next week we'll see in chapter 3 with the story of the fiery furnace. Only Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego are there and have to deal with the fire. Daniel's not in that story. But Daniel's an administrator of a slightly different area. He's in Babylon, they're in the province. Could explain it. Okay, there you are. There's the story. Now, what does it mean? What's the implications of it? Let's just try and unpack that for a moment. The first half of the book of Daniel is very carefully structured. It's what the theologians call a chiastic structure. I'll show you in a moment. Chapter 1's an introduction to the whole thing, and then 2 to 7 work on a chiasm. In my humble way, it's a sandwich. Okay, so you've got the bread, the lettuce, and then the bacon. The bread, the lettuce, and the bacon, and the bacon's the business end of things, as always. I'll show you what I mean. Chiasm sounds a little more intellectual, though, I know. Chapters 2 and chapter 7 are parallel. They're both about four great kingdoms that are to come and God setting up his own kingdom. So we look at 2 today, but 7's parallel. Then 3 and 6 are both about persecution and a miraculous rescue. So chapter 3 about the fiery furnace, and then chapter 6 about the lion's den. And 4 and 5, we'll get to chapter 4 in 2 weeks' time, about God's judgment on the proud emperors or rulers of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 4 ends well, chapter 5 ends in tears, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Okay, so 2 and 7 help us understand each other. Let's have a look. The dream. I read it very quickly, but I'm sure you've got the vibe. The dream is a giant statue with a head of gold, and we're told that's you, Nebuchadnezzar. And then the chest and arms of silver, the belly and thigh of bronze, second and third kingdoms, the legs, feet of iron, legs of iron and then feet of iron and clay. And then there's a rock cut not by human hands that knocks it all over and grows to fill the earth. Now, if I could say, you should be very careful of of speakers who try to plug in Bible prophecy, years, numbers, and history, and tell you what's going to happen. Just be very careful about that, because it's the happy hunting ground for lunatics. Having said that, I'm just about to do it, okay? So, you have now been warned. I was at caveat emptor, or was it let the buyer beware? Here we go. If you see what you think. You weigh it up, okay? I'm just working with some reading and the text, and you weigh it up. The dream in chapter 2 and Daniel's vision in chapter 7 are very much parallel. And they talk about the coming of four great kingdoms and then another kingdom that will be greater than them all. Now let me see if I can plug in some of those things. In Daniel chapter 2, the head of the statue is made of pure gold, and we're told it's the Babylonian Empire. Babylonian Empire begins in the low 600s, maybe 612, Jerusalem falls 605, and there's a fairly clear ending at 539 when the Persians conquer Babylon. Okay. In chapter 7, there's a lion with the wings of the eagle, the kind of majestic Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians. You get to the next one, the chest and arms of silver. And then in chapter 7, there's the idea of a bear with ribs in its mouth, but it's raised up on one side. Now, the Medo-Persian Empire followed the Babylonians, and the Persians were dominant. The dates for the Persian Empire, 539, Cyrus conquers... conquers Babylon. Depending on where you draw the line, sometimes 490, sometimes a bit longer. Interesting, the next one though, it's belly and thighs of bronze. In chapter 7, the next kingdom is a leopard with wings, but with four heads. Alexander the Great, as he literally conquered the world, as chapter 2 says, or conquered the known world, the speed of his conquest was incredible. The leopard had wings. After his death, Alexander died in 323 BC, so it's about 11 years, and he conquered the known world. After his death, his kingdom, there's an incredible fight among his generals because there was no obvious successor, and his kingdom's divided into four. The leopard in chapter 7 has four heads. And then, of course, the next one, the harshest, strongest empire, legs of iron, but also feet of iron and clay, would point to the Romans. And the fourth beast in chapter 7 is bigger, scarier, has iron teeth, crushes everything, and yet is a divided kingdom. Now, my level of ignorance about the Roman Empire is amazing. All right? I would not claim to know too much about it. But one thing you can know is the Roman Empire was divided. They were not short on rebellions or civil wars. Here's just a quick indication. I went to Wikipedia. Roman civil wars and rebellion in the first century BC. There are 22 civil wars or rebellions that are big enough to rate 2,000 years later. If you go to the first century AD, there's 26 civil wars or rebellions. Rome was a divided kingdom, iron and clay and yet amazing strength. Now, Daniel is a controversial book among Bible scholars, etc. For two main reasons. One is it deals with miracles. So you've got the interpretation of dreams, but particularly the fiery furnace, which has generated some heat among scholars, and Daniel and the lion's den, etc. I'll talk more about that next week when we get to chapter 3. But also that... Those inverted commas scholars who are not committed to the authority of the Bible assume that Daniel must be dated in the 2nd century BC, despite the claim that it's written by Daniel in the 6th century BC. Why? Because it so accurately, or well, I guess in general terms, predicts what will happen over the next 3 to 4 centuries. If you're interested to follow through on that, Alan Harmon's commentary on Daniel gives quite a lot of information. A lot of it goes back to S.R. Driver, who wrote in the 1890s and said that various things about the language of Daniel could only have been in the 2nd century. Most of that has been disproved during the 20th century by scholarship. And as far as I can tell, it's largely presuppositional. If you don't believe that the Bible's capable of predictive prophecy, you need to date this very late. Interesting, at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found 7 or 8 scrolls containing Daniel, and they were all treated as part of the canon of the Old Testament. And so It's a debate. I can't see any reason other than presupposition to say that it can't be 6th century and written as claimed by Daniel. What's the claim? The claim is that during the Roman Empire, or what I've identified as the Roman Empire, in the time of those kings, the kings who rule this empire that's so strong and yet also divided, in the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it will itself endure forever. But God will do that. That's the claim. Now, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone, but if you keep reading in this book and keep turning the pages, you'll come to a story of a young Galilean preacher in about 30 AD who steps out of obscurity and begins to speak. Well, gathered crowds to him. They were big crowds at the time, but still crowds that he could speak to without a PA system. And one day as he was speaking beside Lake Galilee, he stepped into a boat to stop being mobbed, and what did he say? Again, he began to teach beside the sea, and a very large crowd gathered about him so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea, and the whole crowd was beside the sea on the land. And here's one of the parables that he told, as he spoke about what he always spoke about, the kingdom of God. And he said, "With what can we compare the kingdom of God, or what parable shall we use for it? It's like a grain of mustard seed which was sown on the ground. It's the smallest of all seeds on earth, and yet when it is sown, it grows up and becomes larger than all the garden plants and puts out large branches so that the birds of the air can make nests in its shade." If you'd like to know what the mustard seed plant looks like, Kevin will know, and he'll tell you later on. Right, mate? Okay. Massive big bush that birds of the air, etc. What's Jesus' point? The kingdom will start very, very small, like a mustard seed, and yet it will grow to fill the world. And the prophecy in Daniel is this. It's God who is doing this, not by human hands. This kingdom will grow not at the point of a sword, not at the point of a sword or through an army, but through a strange message of a crucified carpenter who rose from the dead. Now, has that happened? We're running out of time. Let me just very quickly say, if you just look at the Western world, you can think, oh, Christianity's on the decline, but that's a very myopic view. Worldwide, Christianity is booming. Here's an interesting book. Philip Jenkins, professor of history at Baylor University in Texas, The Next Christendom. This was written in 2002. It's still relevant, but I think it's just beginning to fade in terms of the stats. I waded through the whole book, 250 or so pages. If you want to get the executive summary version, he did an interview in The Atlantic magazine, October 2002. Here's some quick quotes from what he says. Basically what he's talking about is the massive growth of Christianity in what might be called the global south, South America, Africa, and then up into Asia, and really is booming. Quote from The Atlantic magazine, Phil Jenkins says this: "As the media has striven in recent years to present Islam in a more sympathetic light, they've tended to suggest that Islam and not Christianity is the rising faith of Africa and Asia, the authentic and default religion of the world's huddled masses. But Christianity is not only surviving in the global south, it is enjoying a radical revival, a return to scriptural roots." He says, and I quote, "We are living in revolutionary times. Worldwide, Christianity is actually moving towards supernaturalism and neo-orthodoxy, in many ways towards the ancient worldview expressed in the New Testament. In the global south, the areas that we often think of as primarily as the third world, huge and growing Christian populations, currently 480 million in Latin America, 360 million in Africa, 313 million in Asia, compared with 260 million in North America." He says this: "The growth in Africa has been relentless. In 1900, Africa had just 10 million Christians, about 9% of the population. Today, the Christian total stands at 360 million. Now, this was 15 years ago. Within the next 25 years, the population of the world's Christians is expected to grow to 2.6 billion. Now, that's nominal. Rodney Stark's book, The Triumph of Faith, will give more detailed figures. He says, by 2025, 50% of the Christian population will be in Africa, Latin America, and another 17% will be in Asia. It's massive growth, wherever you look. Now, why has that not come up in the media? very quickly, it's not a conspiracy. It just doesn't fit the media's paradigm for reporting. Also, poor person becomes Christian in Asia or Africa isn't newsworthy. Dog rides surfboard at Bondi, that's newsworthy. Okay. So there's two very different views of the future, as I pull up and you may have questions. Yuval Noah Harari, okay, we'll conquer death, we'll all become gods, we'll fix everything. Look, I don't want to ruin anyone's day, but I have a prediction. Everyone in this room is going to die sometime.
No.
No, I think so. So whatever he decides is not for us. That's one view of the future. Every now and then he touches the reality brake pedal. Or the other version is what Jesus promised. His kingdom would grow and fill the world one day. And that he would return. And for those who trusted him, there would be life in a renewed creation. Where there'd be no more mourning or crying or pain. There would be forgiveness and new life. So Daniel chapter 2 asks us, which side of history are we on? Better? Okay. Some interesting questions. You mentioned Jesus as a carpenter. Do we know this? He doesn't use any carpentry similes in his parables. It seems he's more the carpenter's son rather than the carpenter himself. What are your thoughts? Okay. Matthew chapter 13 verse 55 is one of the few references that say definitely he's the carpenter's son. Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary and aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon with us? So the carpenter's son, I think that's right if you pick me up. I'm not sure there's any verse particularly that says Jesus himself worked as a carpenter. Although he went home, he spent time with his mum and dad until he's about 30, Luke says, then he stepped into public life. Interesting, I can't prove this, but I suspect one of the reasons that Jesus waited until 30-something, or partly it was to have the maturity to be able to speak to people, but it's almost certain that his father, Joseph, died between when Jesus was 12 years old and when Jesus was 30-something. Joseph's not mentioned again after Jesus was 12 in Luke chapter 2. And Jesus may well have waited until his siblings, James and others, were old enough to care for mum and take over the family business before Jesus stepped out got about his other his father's business, so to speak. Jesus' parables? I'd have to think about that one. I don't know, carpentry?
Log in the eye.
Well, Ken says he talks about the log in your eye. There, well, that's not bad, Ken, not bad. Interesting, Jesus draws parables from such a wide range, you know, the woman who loses the coins and sweeps the house, about baking and farming in particular. I think as a brilliant teacher, as he walked around, he would point to the farmer in the field and then teach about that, etc. So there's anyone who thinks the teaching of Jesus came up through a committee, I just can't see that. There's a brilliant mind behind the teachings and the way that he teaches. So Matthew 13:55, the carpenter's son. Astrology is often dismissed as laughable by Christians and the secular world. What are we to make of dream interpretation or astrology these days? Didn't the wise men follow astrology, a star, to find baby Jesus? Very interesting, yes. The astrology that you'll find in the back of the trashy magazines that are in the doctor's waiting room is a joke. People just write it and knock it out. In fact, long term, because of the movement of the movement of the equinoxes, the actual where the star signs are in the sky has moved over a period of thousands of years. If you look into it, it's actually out of date. The Old Testament takes astrology and divination and so on very seriously, and it says these things usually are evil. Stay away from them. It doesn't say that it's powerless. They're saying it's real. Stay away. The Magi in Matthew chapter 2, the three wise men, although we're not told there's three, there's just three presents. The Magi come from the east. There's a prophecy in the book of Numbers that talks about a great star rising in the area of the sky associated with Judah. And they've seen this star in the sky. I can say more about that later on if you want, or I have a Time article that's interested about it. They're talked about positively, that they come to worship the king, although we're never told to indulge in astrology, etc. today, very wise man once, only one wise man once said to me this. What's the difference between saying, God spoke to me in a dream, or I had a dream that God spoke to me? Okay? God spoke to me in a dream, or I had a dream that God spoke to me. Now, it's possible that God may speak to you in that way, although in the New Testament, God hasn't promised that he will. He's promised the Bible is sufficient for all decisions we need to make, for all guidance we need to make, if we're a follower of Jesus. He may speak to you in some kind of extracurricular way, but he hasn't promised to. And then you'd have to, did God speak to me in a dream, or did I have a dream God spoke to me? You'd need to take it to the New Testament and run it through the grid very carefully to see whether it fitted with what it is that God has very clearly revealed. So there you go. The astrology, the occult, all those kind of things, the Bible would say it's not that they're powerless. Some of them are fake, but it's not that they're powerless. Generally, it's not good, and you don't need it. Stay away from it. Is it better to have 330 million nominal Christians or 10 who trust Jesus? I'll go for the 10, thanks. The problem with those massive numbers, Rodney Stark, who... I like it on the record that I only quoted Rodney Stark once in this talk. Is it? Okay, good, thank you. More next week. Rodney Stark's book, The Triumph of Faith, picks up on the World Gallup Poll Survey. And they survey 160 countries. Well, China won't let them in, unfortunately, for the accuracy. But 160 countries other than China on all sorts of different social issues. And what they came up with is about 2.2 billion people around the planet say, yes, I'm a Christian. But there's 51% of Australians say they're Christian still, but only 8% turn up at church. So the nominal figure is not very meaningful. So what they decided to do was then to ask, have you been to a place of worship in the last week? And if you've turned up a church in the last week, there's a much higher chance that you are a genuine follower. The number then drops to about 1.2 billion. So there's the... All right. Those big pictures, I'm not sure they can base too much on it, other than the fact to say Christianity is not declining worldwide. It may be declining in the rich and comfortable Western world, but in the developing world, Christianity is growing and growing rapidly.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.